This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, January 30th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the U.S. Senate considers proposals to reduce gun violence in its first hearing since the Newtown school shooting. Parents and students from public schools across the U.S. converge in Washington, D.C. to demand a halt to school closings. They say the closures target students of color and disrupt communities. And why did a hearing at the Guantanamo Military Commission's suddenly go dark? We'll hear from Truthout's Jason Leopold at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to find out what happened. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A Dutch court has ruled that Royal Dutch Shell can be held partially responsible for pollution in Nigeria's Niger Delta. The court also ordered the oil giant to pay damages to one farmer. FSRN's Samuel Okocha reports from Lagos.
Four Nigerians, backed by the environmental group Friends of the Earth, filed the suit in 2008 in The Hague, home of Shell's global headquarters. The lawsuit sought unspecified reparations for water and land contamination in the Niger Delta, linked to Shell's oil operations there. In its judgment today, the court dismissed most of the allegations, but found the oil company responsible for one case of pollution. Human rights advocate Rosemary Okori tells FSRN that the case will encourage more claims related to the foreign activities of multinational companies.
With this verdict against Shell, a multinational, a lot many other things will begin to change. People who need to raise awareness about their problems will go a step further in bringing the requisite attention to their issues.
Critics say the judgment was mild. Shell had blamed saboteurs for the oil leaks, and the court sided with the company on four or five of the claims. Friends of the Earth has indicated it will appeal those rulings. Samuel Okocha, FSRN, Lagos.
The Zimbabwean parliament is set to endorse a new draft constitution tomorrow. The document, which has been 3 years in the making, is expected to go to a nationwide referendum as early as March. If passed, national elections would follow later that year, potentially signaling the end of a continuing political crisis triggered by fraudulent elections in 2008. FSRN's Mishak Rusere reports from the capital, Harare.
Government leaders, including Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, are supporting the constitution, saying it will usher in a new era. Douglas Munzora is co-chair of the Constitution Select Committee.
We think it's a breakthrough. By going to the parliament tomorrow, we are happy Zimbabweans because we know that if they go there, they are going to endorse the constitution-making process, which has been the derailing factor all along.
The new constitution includes several controversial provisions, including presidential term limits and capping the power of the presidency, currently held by longtime leader Robert Mugabe. The new document also includes guarantees of press and political activity freedoms, but keeps a ban on same-sex marriage and upholds the death penalty. Misha Kruser, Harare.
The governor of Massachusetts has selected Mo Cowan to replace John Kerry in the U.S. Senate. Cowan was Governor Deval Patrick's chief of staff. He will hold the seat until a special election can be held this summer, but he says he does not intend to run in that race. Cowan's appointment means for the first time, two African Americans will be serving in the U.S. Senate concurrently. Climate change is already having a significant effect on wildlife populations in the U.S., and it's expected to get worse for many species. That's according to a new report out today from the National Wildlife Federation. Report author Amanda Stott says sometimes changing temperatures don't directly affect wildlife, but the indirect effects are just as severe. She cites the shifting range of the whitebark pine beetle.
What happens when you have these kind of infestations is that you have ripple-down effects on other species within that ecosystem. And one example that we highlight in the report is grizzly bears in Yellowstone National Park.
Stott says the grizzlies have fewer cubs when the whitebark pine nut supply is low, and there are more conflicts with humans as bears seek out new food sources. As wildlife ranges shift, the report recommends governments and individuals ensure animals have pathways to move into new habitats. Community groups in dozens of U.S. cities rallied today, calling for big corporations to pay a higher percentage of taxes. This comes as another budget showdown is brewing in Washington that could result in dramatic reductions in social service funding. From New York, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
Pay your taxes! Fix the debt!
About 50 people, including Karen Null, protested today in front of NBC's 30 Rock building, which is owned by General Electric.
We're here in front of GE today because CEO Jeffrey Immelt is on the board of a group called the Fix the Debt Campaign.
Fix the Debt is a lobbying group of about 90 corporate CEOs that back sequestration cuts. The cuts are mostly supported by Republicans and would severely reduce funding to social services like Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
They want to fix the debt that they caused by taking away benefits from millions of hardworking Americans.
Florence Johnson is an advocate for New York Communities for Change.
And we're here to serve notice on them that they can fix the debt if they just pay their fair share in taxes.
Pay your share. Pay your share.
The protesters are demanding an end to corporate tax breaks. They say shift the burden to working people. Meanwhile, Congress has a March 1st deadline to agree on a deal to avoid sequestration cuts. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, New York.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Senate held its first hearing since the Newtown school shooting on proposals to stem gun violence. Lawmakers debated stricter background checks, bans on certain kinds of weapons and ammunition, and plans to arm more citizens. This week's shootings on a school bus in Alabama and near a school in Chicago claimed more lives, and another shooting in Arizona injured more during the Senate hearing. Yet the lawmakers on the Judiciary Committee and the expert witnesses failed to agree today on a path forward. One key Democrat plans to hold her own hearings in the coming weeks. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Three of the five witnesses at Wednesday's hearing told senators that the government shouldn't enact any new gun control measures because people need assault weapons and large clips of ammunition for self-defense. National Rifle Association CEO Wayne LaPierre added that those people shouldn't have to go through the bureaucracy of background checks at gun shows. Baltimore Police Chief James Johnson called this argument insane.
It's not an inconvenience. The record shows that nearly 92% of the individuals that go in to try to do a background check at a gun shop, in a minute and a half, they're done. I can't write a citation that fast.
Johnson voiced support for stronger background checks and the new assault weapons ban introduced by California Democrat Dianne Feinstein earlier this month. While Feinstein agreed with the pro-gun witnesses and lawmakers at the hearing that mental health issues and violent media culture should also be addressed, she said the NRA's LaPierre is wrong for opposing any restrictions on gun ownership.
He makes his claim that everybody is entitled to these weapons. My view is everybody is entitled to be safe and go to a movie without a threat of getting mowed down. The NRA says guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, there are always going to be people, no matter what you do.
Yet the other witnesses at Wednesday's hearing, David Koppel with the Libertarian Cato Institute and Gail Trotter with the Pro-Gun Independent Women's Forum, testified that having more guns in schools and homes would better protect children and families. And the Republican senators on the committee, who all have A ratings from the NRA, agreed. One of them, Iowa's Chuck Grassley, said the proposed assault weapons ban and the president's recent campaign to address gun violence could, quote, lead to tyrannical federal government.
This necessarily and understandably leads many citizens to fear that their individual rights will be violated. It should be a matter of deep concern to all of us.
The NRA's PAC spent more than $55,000 to re-elect Grassley in 2010, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. He's just one of 11 members of the committee to receive major donations from the organization. The political and economic power of the NRA and other gun lobby groups prompted former Congressmember and gun violence survivor Gabrielle Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly to form their own PAC last year called Americans for Responsible Solutions. They plan to help elect politicians who support gun control measures. Giffords, who was shot with a semi-automatic weapon in early 2011, and still suffers from physical and mental disabilities, gave a short statement at Wednesday's hearing.
Speaking is difficult, but I need to say something important. Violence is a big problem. Too many children are dying. Too many children. We must do something. It will be hard, but the time is now. You must act.
Later in the nearly four-hour-long hearing, Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin said the story of 15-year-old Hadiyah Pendleton, who was shot and killed Tuesday in Chicago, should spur lawmakers to quickly pass gun control legislation. Senator Feinstein plans to hold her own hearings on her assault weapons ban bill and other gun control measures in the coming weeks. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
Public school parents and students from 18 cities across the country gathered in Washington, D.C. this week to demand a nationwide moratorium on school closings. They argue that schools are often closed without public input, and that harms students and disrupts entire communities. Critics say most school closings target communities of color, which makes them a violation of their civil rights. FSRN's Jessel Knorr reports.
Federal programs like Race to the Top offered financial incentives for cities and states for radically changing their schools, including firing staff and shutting schools down. While the Obama administration touted the competitive multi-billion-dollar program as a way to improve education and better prepare students for college and the workforce, many parents, students, and teachers say the changes are disproportionately affecting low-income communities of color.
I came here to demand. I ain't asking for not a damn thing. I'm telling you that I am demanding an education for our children. We pay the money. We send our children to the schools. They are our schools. They are our children. It is our money. And that's my attitude over all these years.
That's Helen Moore, a longtime civil rights leader and Detroit education activist. She is one of hundreds who attended a hearing Tuesday in Washington, D.C., calling for a national moratorium on school closings. Moore was part of a group that filed a Title VI civil rights complaint last summer, challenging the policies. She says school closings in Detroit, a city already marked by high rates of unemployment, vacant houses, and foreclosures, are destabilizing the community.
Neighborhoods start going down as the families move out. They don't want to be told which school they have to go to because there's no other choice for them to go to.
When a school is closed, the student population often has to travel to a different school building or reapply to go back to their school. Additionally, the staff is often replaced and resources are regularly cut, sometimes in favor of a charter school that is opened in the same building. Seth Galanter is with the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. He said they are investigating people's concerns and the six Title VI complaints that were filed.
The question we're asking when we go to these communities is whether a school district made its decision with the intent to discriminate or whether the decisions have illegal discriminatory effects on students of color. In investigating these complaints, we're not only going to examine the decision to close schools, but the decision about which schools to close, where the students are being reassigned from these closed schools, how these decisions are being implemented, and the effects on the students.
After the hearing, hundreds of parents and students marched to the Martin Luther King Memorial for a rally, continuing their call for justice. Joel Velasquez, a parent from Oakland, California, says he fought plans to shut his son's school by leading a three-week-long sit-in at Lakeview Elementary.
Well, after a year of, you know, trying to meet with our local officials and superintendent and our board members, we were left with no option, and we actually took back our school on the last day of the school year, on June 13, 2012.
A delegation from New Orleans, the city with the highest proportion of charter schools in the country, also traveled to D.C. Student Terrell Major says his public school gets less resources than the charter school that shares the same building.
Like when the storm Isaac came, after we came back from the storm, this side of the cafeteria, because we sit on separate sides of the cafeteria. Their side of the cafeteria was fixed up immediately, and our side was left damaged for weeks.
How did that make you feel?
Made me feel like I was lesser than. Almost as if I was, like, not relevant, like I didn't really matter in my own school.
Major calls that discrimination. Despite the challenges, some are encouraged by the growing grassroots movement against school closings, including New Orleans parent and activist Karen Harper Royal.
I think we are at a turning point because there are people organizing in different ways all over the country. In Seattle, it's around testing. We're organizing around school closures. There are teachers who are organizing around their evaluation system. There are different grassroots groups of people who are organizing around many different facets of what is being called education reform. We are definitely at a critical point because, after all, we're not getting the desired outcome.
Keep on talking, marching up the freedom.
One more time!
Let nobody...
In addition to a nationwide moratorium on school closings, activists are calling for sustainable school transformation, increased resources, and a community-based input process. Organizers have vowed to return to Washington if the Department of Education does not take action. Jessel Noor, FSRN, Washington.
Myanmar's armed forces have intensified attacks against the ethnic Kachin rebels near the border with China. The military for the country, also known as Burma, stepped up attacks just miles from the headquartered township of Lhasa, despite calls for a ceasefire. As FSRN's Ron Corbin reports, the escalation in the fighting has raised fears by humanitarian organizations about the welfare of thousands of internally displaced people as the government pushes to end the Kachin armed resistance.
Helicopter gunships, backed up to 3,000 Myanmar troops, pounded a key outlook held by the Kachin Independence Army in northern Myanmar, also known as Burma. In video footage obtained by Irrawaddy News magazine, rebel soldiers attempted to fight back, firing mortars at the Myanmar troop position. Fighting around the Ka Yabum hilltop outpost has intensified over recent weeks as Myanmar's army has gradually gained ground against the Kachin army despite a reported ceasefire being in place by President Thein Sein. After heavy shelling late last week, Kachin forces retreated from Ka Yabum, the last defensive outpost near the township and Kachin headquarters of Lhasa. The fighting has escalated since Christmas Day, when the Myanmar army began using Russian-made helicopter gunships, referred to as flying tanks, attacking ethnic political resistance forces. Corinne Dean is a specialist researcher on the Kachin at the Tallinn University in Estonia. She says as the conflict escalates, the Kachin Independence Organization, or KIO, may be facing a critical moment in the five-decade struggle for autonomy.
Of course, the government has power and equipment, is well equipped to perhaps take over Lhasa and crush the Kachin positions, but it will not be able to stop the violence. The KIO maybe have another tactic underground. I mean, it cannot really crush the resistance. There will be political resistance.
A 17-year-long ceasefire between the previous military government and Kachin forces broke down in mid-2011. Tensions had been rising after the Kachin refused to act as border guards and the Kachin political parties were refused registration by the government. In 2010 national elections, the government ruled out voting in Kachin state due to what it termed security reasons. The Kachin, along with other ethnic communities, have been calling for greater autonomy under the present constitution. The loss of Ka Yabum outpost is a major blow for the Kachin, whose troops were forced to retreat. A Kachin spokesperson, Colonel James Lumdur, claimed in a statement to FSRN that Kachin forces had retaken the outpost late Saturday. The claim could not be independently verified. He also repeated recent accusations of Myanmar troops using chemical weapons. The claim has been denied by the Myanmar government. A defence analyst at Australia's University of New South Wales, Carl Thayer, says Myanmar's army is pressing for a new ceasefire with the Kachin forces.
You know, the strategy, well, one, I mean, it's obviously to gain an upper hand. If the momentum is swinging and they can push and seize the capital, then the ceasefire comes and they have it in place. They're there. The attempt to get a ceasefire would cause the military to push even harder because it would solidify the gains it's got on the ground.
But others, including Tallinn University's Dr. Dean, says the outlook for the Kachin would be bleak under a new ceasefire.
Currently, during the ceasefire, the KIO has been controlling areas near the border that in some ways has provided the Kachin community survival and security to them, and also autonomy to pursue various grassroots projects, education, and particularly education. Because in KIO-controlled areas, Kachin language higher education, it is the only place where Kachin language higher education has been provided.
For rights and humanitarian groups, the fighting has led to increased concerns over tens of thousands of internally displaced people. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs spokesperson in Yangon, Stuart Davies, says international organisations are calling for access to conflict areas to assess the needs of civilians.
More than ever now, we're concerned about civilians caught in this conflict, and really we're trying to reiterate that we've got a concern for 75,000 people already and have been since June of last year. So in our key messages, we continue to advocate government to get access. We need access first, and then we can follow up a lot.
Some analysts say Myanmar's government is seeking to extend control over a region rich in resources. Several countries, including the United States and the United Nations, have raised concerns over the rising violence. But Myanmar state-controlled media challenged the criticism, accusing the Kachin of terrorist actions and atrocities. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
This week, Ali Sheikh Mohammed and four other defendants accused of planning the September 11th terrorist attacks are facing a pretrial hearing at the Guantanamo Bay Military Commissions. At issue are a number of motions, including access to evidence and classified information, and whether the torture of defendants while in U.S. custody at CIA black sites can be part of the trial. The proceedings were interrupted at one point this week when the audio and video feed was suddenly blacked out after one of the defense attorneys began discussing the CIA black sites. Reporter Jason Leopold was there, and he joins us on the line from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where he's been monitoring the hearing this week for Truthout. The quality of the line is patchy, but we're going to do our best. Jason, welcome to FSRN.
Thank you so much for having me on.
This week, the defense has been working through a number of motions in this pretrial hearing. What has been the subject of some of those this week?
Well, most of the motions that we're hearing this week, or what we have heard since Monday, they're really, really technical legal motions. Much of it has to do with the sharing of information, classified information. The defense also wanted to have access to the high-value prisoner camp, which is known as Camp 7, which is where all of the high-value detainees, prisoners, are held. There's 14 of them, obviously 5 on trial here, and they want to have access to it and spend 48 hours at that camp in order to see the conditions in which they're, which the accused are living under.
And has Judge Pohl ruled on that motion?
He hasn't. What's at issue with regard to that motion is how lengthy will be, defense will have access to it. So, for example, the defense wants to spend 2 days, 48 hours, at these camps, literally sort of living in the shoes of their clients to see what the conditions are. Whereas the prosecution is saying, look, that's too much time. How are we going to handle, classified information? Who can they speak to? We don't want them speaking to any random guards. It's such a secure facility that the defense teams are not, or rather the prosecution is not open to having them there at that amount of time. So this is something that the judge is trying to work out.
Talk about what happened Monday. There was a 3-minute period in the proceedings when the audio and video was blacked out. The military judge, James Pohl, at the time appeared not to understand why. What happened?
In this courtroom, just to sort of describe it to you, and you know, I also need to note here that, you know, since I'm speaking to you, you know, from Guantanamo on a phone at Guantanamo, all of our, you know, our discussions are being monitored. So the sticker on the phone that actually states that explicitly. But you know, one of the issues that, you know, popped up on Monday was the use of a, you know, what's known as a sensor button. It basically to prevent classified information from being discussed in open court. The judge and the court security officer, they have access to, they just hit a button. And when they hit that button, it triggers a red flashing light on the judge's, you know, on his bench. And, you know, it sort of looks like a siren. And the defense attorney for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, David Nevin, he was discussing issues related to the CIA black site detention facilities where KSM was being held. And as soon as he went into that discussion, as soon as he actually said the word secret, this red flashing light went on, and we, the media and other observers, you know, were sitting in the gallery in the courtroom, and it's separated by, you know, thick soundproof glass, and it's already on a 40-second delay. The audio feed to the closed circuit television, which we follow, it went dead. There was white noise. The feed was killed. And when they returned 3 minutes later, the judge had no idea who hit this button.
So as you describe it, there is this 40-second delay already with audio and video. During this blackout, the military judge appeared not to understand why. You said the prosecutors did appear to understand why. Did the attorneys for the defendants understand why this was taking place?
No, and they made it very clear that they had no idea, you know, that this was being used. It was sort of this revelation, even though many had suspected it, that the CIA is also monitoring these proceedings and seems to have control over this button, which the judge appeared to be surprised about, although the prosecution says he was already well aware.
And Jason Leopold, very quickly, the hearings continue this week. What's next?
Well, actually, you know, the hearings were supposed to be all week, meaning Monday through Thursday, 28th through the 31st. So today, Wednesday, there is actually a day off for us, for the media and the NGOs that are here observing as well, because there are motions that are being discussed in closed court. So there's a closed session. It's going to pick up again sometime next week. In fact, next week there will also be the al-Nashiri case that he is the alleged mastermind behind the USS Cole. So that will pick up next week here, and then following that, also in February, the KSM hearings will continue.
Jason Leopold, lead investigator, reporter with Truth Out, joined us from Guantanamo Bay, where he's covering the hearing this week. Jason Leopold, thank you very much for joining us.
I appreciate you having me on.
And you can follow Jason's work at truthout.org. And that's the program for today. And the newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marino.